From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Both Yunus Kalimba and the U.S. were urging the Pakistanis to continue military supplies to the Taliban so that they could quickly conquer the rest of the country.
The oil slick road to war on Afghanistan. We'll talk with Ahmed Rashid in Pakistan and John Pilger in Britain. Pilger says the war on terrorism is a fraud. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. bombers attacked the strategic northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif early today, and U.S. jets targeted areas near the front lines and airstrikes coordinated with anti-Taliban fighters. U.S. planes also struck Kandahar. The western Herat province, the Taliban news agency, says U.S. planes dropped cluster bombs near several U.N. refugee camps. One person died after picking up an unexploded bomblet, according to the news agency. In related news, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf said yesterday he would not press Washington to halt bombing during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, a call made by Muslim leaders around the world. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said yesterday he hoped U.S. military raids on Afghanistan would end soon so that relief workers could step up deliveries of badly needed aid for millions of Afghans facing possible starvation. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged yesterday that U.S. soldiers are at a base inside Afghanistan coordinating attacks with the Northern Alliance. Northern Alliance officials said such coordination will increase in coming days and that Alliance forces were planning a major offensive to wrest the strategic northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif from the Taliban. According to The Nation, a Pakistani newspaper seen as close to the military, the U.S. has begun consulting with Pakistan and other allies about launching a large-scale ground attack on Afghanistan. General Tommy Franks, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Central Command, discussed this with the Pakistani president during their meeting on Monday. U.S. diplomats are attacking Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for a speech he gave on Monday in which he condemned the September 11th suicide attacks but made an impassioned plea for an end to, quote, the killing of innocents in Afghanistan. Chavez suggested that military operations against Afghanistan amounted to fighting terror with more terror and said there could be, quote, no justification of any kind for civilian casualties, even those killed by mistake. In Kandahar, U.S. fighter jets in a pre-dawn air raid hit a dispensary of the Red Crescent Society today, killing 11 people. Among the survivors was Dr. Obaidullah, who runs the Red Crescent facility in Kandahar and whose head, right hand, and left leg are in bandages from wounds he said he sustained in the raid. The doctor said 11 people, including patients and staff at the facility, had been killed and 6 wounded in the bombing. The United Nations today says its envoy to Afghanistan had rejected a request by the Taliban ambassador in Pakistan for a meeting. The UN envoy is in Pakistan for several days for discussions with a wide range of people on how to form an Afghan government to replace the current Taliban administration. The Taliban has since January refused to talk with the UN, which imposed sanctions on Afghanistan in January. A New York hospital worker is gravely ill with inhalation anthrax yesterday as the widening list of victims prompted health investigators to wonder whether they have underestimated just how infectious the bacteria might be. The hospital worker became the first person in the country outside the news media or the postal service to be infected with the deadliest form of the disease. A day earlier, a New Jersey woman with a skin infection became the first person in New Jersey with no links to the postal service to contract anthrax. In Washington, where the disease has killed 2 postal workers, officials shut down 2 more post offices and planned a 2-week decontamination of an anthrax-tainted Senate office building. The latest victims raised the number of confirmed anthrax cases to 17 nationwide since the outbreak began in the first week of October. 10 of the victims had the inhaled form and 3 have died. 7 others have less severe skin infections. This news from Washington, saying they felt compelled by the government's refusal to answer its previous inquiries. A coalition of civil liberties, human rights, and electronic privacy organizations is filing a Freedom of Information Act request for information about the people arrested or detained since September 11th. Nearly 1,000 people have been arrested or detained since then, nearly all of them immigrants or people of Middle Eastern descent. And this news about the airline industry. The House votes tomorrow on aviation security legislation. On October 11th, the Senate voted 100-0 for a bill that makes all airport security screeners federal workers with the same professional status as customs or immigration officials. But Bush and House Republicans have objected strongly to putting 28,000 screeners on the federal payroll and opening them to union representation. And British Prime Minister Tony Blair sought to bolster public support for the military action in Afghanistan yesterday, saying there is now a flood of evidence proving that Osama bin Laden is responsible for the attacks on the United States. This after a poll released in Britain showed a majority of the population supports a halt of bombing. Blair also sought to muzzle growing criticism of the war from within the British Labour Party.
Everywhere I go, I tell this. When I meet somebody who says there's really no hope, you know, things are going to get from worse to worse, and this is the last century of the human race, I tell them, did you expect to see our great Watergate president leave office the way he did? And they say, no, I guess I didn't. I said, did you expect the Pentagon to have to leave Vietnam the way it did? No, I didn't. I said, did you expect to see the Berlin Wall come down so peacefully the way it did? They said, no, I really didn't expect that. Then I said, did you expect to see Mandela, head of South Africa? Oh, no, I really didn't expect that. I thought he'd rot in jail forever, the rest of his life. Well, I said, if you couldn't predict those things, don't be confident that you can predict there's no hope.
Well, may the fiddle sound, the banjo play, the old hoedown, dancers swinging round and round.
Well, may the world go, Larry Long and Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The war is a fraud. Renowned British journalist John Pilger is grabbing headlines around the world this week for this cover story in a paper which has historically been a staunch supporter of Prime Minister Tony Blair. He writes in The Mirror, "The war against terrorism is a fraud. After 3 weeks bombing, not a single terrorist implicated in the attacks on the United States has been caught or killed in Afghanistan. Instead, one of the poorest, most stricken nations has been terrorized by the most powerful, to the point where U.S. pilots have run out of dubious military targets and are now destroying mud houses, a hospital, Red Cross warehouses, lorries carrying refugees." He went on to say, "Bush's concealed agenda is to exploit the oil and gas reserves in the Caspian Basin, the greatest source of untapped fossil fuel on Earth, and enough, according to one estimate, to meet America's voracious energy needs for a generation." We're joined on the phone now by John Pilger. Welcome to The War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us about this story that has appeared on the front page of the Daily Mirror.
Well, the Daily Mirror is a mass circulation tabloid, as you undoubtedly know. It was the biggest selling newspaper in the Western world. I worked on it for quite a long time. It achieved quite a remarkable transformation and became a serious, lively Labour Party supporting and generally left-leaning tabloid newspaper. And then it went into decline after Robert Maxwell, the well-known crook, took it over. And it seems to have come back into its own right in since September the 11th. I haven't had anything to do with it for 15 years, and I was called by the editor who asked me to write about it. And the result was on Monday, a really landmark issue, I think, in newspapers in this country, perhaps anywhere in the West. All over the front page, it said, "This war is a fraud." And inside, it carried a piece by me, which really gave, I think, the view of the view of the growing number of people in this country and elsewhere that the war indeed is a fraud, that it isn't about catching terrorists. It's got many other agendas to it. It had, as the press can have in this country, an almost instant effect. Downing Street was, of course, enraged. But the reaction from the Prime Minister in a speech yesterday was a certain change of tune. It was an acknowledgement that that there is a body of opinion now in this country that believes in not in bombing people in order to win this so-called war on terrorism. He no longer talked about opponents of the war as appeasers. So things are changing quite dramatically here, I think.
Your main thesis in this article is that this war is about oil. Can you explain?
Well, I don't think it's entirely about oil. I think that's a major component. It always is in that part of the world, isn't it? I mean, you know, this is a region called the Greatest Prize by the State Department in 1945, and it remains the Greatest Prize with the United States' voracious energy needs now really becoming quite desperate in the long term, not in the short term, of course. And one of the strategic aims of the Clinton and Bush administrations has been to explore and exploit the oil and gas reserves untapped in former Soviet Central Asia. And I've always felt that piping that wealth, that natural wealth, either to Europe or south to Asia, and certainly onto the United States, has been something of a hidden agenda to much of what has happened in the Balkans. And I think there's, without doubt, the pipeline which would run through Afghanistan is part of the agenda in that part of the world. When the Taliban came to power in 1996, Washington fell very quiet about this, didn't say anything at all. Shortly afterwards, certain leading members of the regime, Taliban regime, were invited to Houston by Unocal, the oil company, which was then trying to get up the deal of the pipeline through Afghanistan, from the Caspian Basin through Afghanistan. And they offered, as I understand it, a cut of something like 15% to the Taliban. The whole thing fell through after the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa. But the same potential is there. Afghanistan doesn't have any real natural resources itself, but it is a crucial point through which a pipeline can go. It can only go through Russia or Iran, and that just wouldn't be possible for the Americans to control it. They could control it with a pliable regime in Afghanistan, and I think that's at least part of the reason. It's certainly not the whole reason. Part of the reason for Powell talking about moderate Taliban and a loose federation and nation building and all that stuff.
John Pilger, you quote a U.S. diplomat saying the Taliban will probably develop like the Saudis did. He explained that Afghanistan would become an American oil colony. There would be huge profits for the West, no democracy, and the legal persecution of women. He said, we can live with that.
Yeah. Well, that was after the Taliban had been in Texas, and that's not very surprising. I mean, that's the situation in Saudi Arabia, where the U.S.-led oil consortium has been the major force in that country for a very long time. It's exactly that in Kuwait. The whole history of the Middle East and of the oil region is of Western countries, the British and the French to begin with, and then the U.S., really propping up these sheikdoms and autocratic regimes as a kind of quasi-oil colonies. I don't think a great deal has changed there, really.
You talk about the Caspian Basin being the greatest source of untapped fossil fuel on Earth.
That's oil industry people are saying that. Whether it is that or not, the jury's out. But it's certainly being talked up that way within the oil industry, and the interest in it, both from the U.S. and from Russia. Russia especially not wanting to lose the pipeline rights from there is very important. So I think it's a major factor. I think this whole war on terrorism is just non-existent, really. When you look at the way it is being used to accelerate a whole swag of other issues inside the United States, with the restriction now of so many basic civil liberties, the potential of that happening in this country, the speeding up of globalization issues like TRIPS before the World Trade Organization, I think. Undoubtedly, it would be good to have the head of Osama bin Laden from the administration's point of view. But I think a lot of the activity, the bombing, the pressures, the bribing of various countries, Blair's frenetic travels, I think that they really have to do with something else. And that something else has been happening since 1989, post-Cold War, the kind of new order that Blair spoke about recently. That's run into a few difficulties lately. There's been a pretty vigorous anti-globalization movement. There's been some opposition in Congress to various measures, most of which have now appeared to have collapsed. There's been a growing awareness, I think, to the various agendas of Western power in the world. A lot of that can be now obfuscated by the so-called war on terrorism.
Finally, John Pilger, we're going to be going to Ahmed Rashid in a minute to talk about the whole issue of oil in Afghanistan, extending what you were saying. But last week, a member of the British Parliament launched Labour Against the War, a group of MPs opposed to the bombing of Afghanistan, with three of Blair's ministers likening the critics of British policy to those who appeased the Nazis before the Second World War. Your comment?
Well, Blair's dropped that, as I said. That really backfired. That doesn't work in this country, actually. It's so over the top. It's so ridiculous that people just make mockery of it. And I think an otherwise silent House of Commons, silent backbenchers anyway, in terms of any criticism of the war. I think that's over. I think the ranks are now breaking, that appeasement, you can forget it. There's now a real open questioning in this country of a kind I haven't seen for some time. It's very hopeful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. British journalist John Pilger speaking to us from London. Thank you. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we will follow the oil slick road to the war on Afghanistan. We'll go to Pakistan to speak with Ahmed Rashid.
Somebody please tell me what is war all about, and why must they kill against my will? I just can't figure it out. Oh,
stop the war now.
Good God, hear me say,
don't put it off
another day. Everybody says,
stop the war now,
now, now, now.
Don't put it off
another day. All we got to do is listen. You think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we called it off.
Ow! Stop the war now.
Good God, hear me say.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier in this unprecedented collaboration of public media broadcasting on public access television stations around the country. Here in New York, it's Manhattan Neighborhood Network on channel 34 and 56. We're broadcasting on Dish Network, Free Speech TV channel 9415, on community radio stations around the country, including Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. And we're broadcasting on the web at wbix.org. You can find us at webactive.com. And we've just launched our new website, democracynow.org. We also welcome people in our area. We're broadcasting from New York, from just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood, in a historic firehouse. We're going to be launching the screening of Democracy Now! To a public on Saturday night. That's November 3rd at St. Paul the Apostle on 8 o'clock Saturday night, which is at 405 West 59th Street at 8 o'clock, and we hope to see people there. Activist rocker Patti Smith will also be performing live. We're going to continue our discussion now of the oil slick road to war in Afghanistan. Despite the rhetoric of human rights and stopping aggression, it was clear why the U.S. was involved in the bombing of Iraq 10 years ago in the Persian Gulf War. It was about oil. It was about preserving the largest source of U.S. oil in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. But with the war in Afghanistan, the role of oil is murkier. No hostile troops posing a direct threat to functioning U.S. oil fields. But there is an important story to tell. When the Soviet Union fell and the Central Asian republics gained their independence, Western oil companies began trying to find a way to export oil out of the landlocked Central Asian countries. The U.S. oil giant Chevron, with the support of the U.S. government, focused on Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan spent years trying to persuade Russia to allow Chevron to transport oil through Russian pipelines to Europe. Well, the U.S. oil company Unocal chose instead to court the oil and gas-rich Turkmenistan. It's been locked in a ferocious and highly secretive battle with the Argentine oil company Brightus for years in a bid to construct a pipeline from Turkmenistan to Pakistan, right through the heart of Afghanistan. The U.S. government wasn't interested in the Turkmenistan project at first, in large part because the pipeline's safety couldn't be guaranteed. Afghanistan was in the midst of civil war. But gradually, it became clear that Chevron wasn't gaining ground in Kazakhstan. Unocal stepped up its pressure, hiring former top-level administration officials, including Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, to lobby the Clinton administration. And then, in 1996, the Taliban took Kabul. Washington thought the Taliban might be able to conquer the rest of the country and bring a stable, if incredibly repressive, government to the country. The U.S. began quietly, in the words of Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, romancing the Taliban. To put these pieces together, Rashid spent 7 months traveling, over 100 interviews, and total immersion in the literature of the oil business. Rashid is the author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, and he joins us on the telephone from Islamabad. Ahmed Rashid, let's start off by you describing what you call the new great game.
Well, the oil issue became extremely important when the U.S. was supporting the Taliban between 1994 and 1997. One of the reasons for U.S. support to the Taliban was based on the fact that the U.S. wanted to build a strategic pipeline from the oil and gas resources in Central Asia down south to the Arabian Sea. And the route through Afghanistan and Pakistan was the shortest route, was the cheapest route, and it was hoped that although there was a civil war going on in Afghanistan, that by the Taliban would provide a kind of security force for such a pipeline. And several oil companies were involved in competing for this pipeline, even in the midst of the civil war, including a major U.S. company, Unocal. And really, you know, the Taliban never signed on to any one company. They kept playing off one company against the other very cleverly, extracting the maximum benefit from each company. And as part of this game, of course, was also the fact that the Russians, the Iranians, who wanted pipelines built along through their countries, became extremely annoyed and, in fact, stepped up support to the anti-Taliban Northern Alliance. And this was a reflection, as I thought at the time, of the great game of the 19th century, when the Tsarist Empire of Russia and the British Empire in India were competing in Afghanistan for influence. And, of course, that was a kind of political great game, but this was a great game for energy and for pipelines.
This issue of Unocal at the very beginning of the rise of the Taliban, saying right away that they thought that when the Taliban had captured Kabul, that the pipeline project would be easier to implement with the Taliban there. And then you had the State Department following up saying it would establish diplomatic relations with the Taliban. Can you describe how Unocal drove U.S. policy for a while?
Well, you know, it was a mixture of both. You had enormous support from the State Department. I mean, senior officials from the State Department would visit the Taliban and then give press conferences saying that they were supporting the Unocal effort and that they urged the Taliban to do the same thing. Unocal was pushing on its own account, enlisting the Pakistanis, Arab states. It formed a consortium of several smaller oil companies in the region. It set up a training center for Afghans to train them in electrical training and pipe fitting in Kandahar, the Taliban headquarters. So it was a situation where Unocal and the State Department were basically driving each other, and the pipeline was being used to assert kind of U.S. influence. And both Unocal and the U.S. were urging the Pakistanis to continue military supplies to the Taliban so that they could quickly conquer the rest of the country.
Can you explain very briefly U.S. policy since the Soviet Union was forced out of Afghanistan when it comes to oil policy there?
Well, after the Soviets withdrew in 1989, I mean, the Americans walked away from Afghanistan. They paid no interest whatsoever. And they only came back in 94. And in the meantime, of course, there was this very bloody civil war inside the country. And then they came back to Afghanistan in 94 when the Taliban came up and this pipeline issue was raised. So between 1994 and 97, you see a lot of interest by the Americans from a distance, by supporting their two major allies in the region, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, to help the Taliban make advances against the Northern Alliance. But then immediately after, you know, in 97, what you get is, you know, the Taliban capture Kabul, and then you get the presence of bin Laden in Afghanistan. Bin Laden links up with Mullah Muhammad Umar, the leader of the Taliban, and at the same time, you get a very strong feminist movement in the United States. American women writing to Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and complaining that why is the U.S. backing a group which is not allowing freedom for women, education for women, such as the Taliban. And I think the Clinton administration was basically very embarrassed by this feminist movement in the United States and then eventually dropped all support for the Taliban.
You also talk about Israel's support of the Taliban.
Well, you know, at that point in time, U.S. policy and Israeli policy was totally involved and committed to surrounding Iran, isolating Iran, ensuring that all the neighbors of Iran would keep it isolated and contained. It was a policy of dual containment, containing Iraq and containing Iran. Now, Israel was part of that policy. It was in Israel's interest to see Iran contained. And it was for that kind of very inadvertent reason that the Israelis were on board with the U.S. Policy of supporting the Taliban. And in fact, the Israelis were also quite interested in this American pipeline as well. And there were reports that some Israeli businessmen were very keen to join the consortium, but that Unocol discouraged it in case it created a problem for them, you know, amongst the very conservative Islamic Taliban. So Israel at that time, you know, was very supportive and encouraged the Americans, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, even though they had no ties with Pakistan, formal diplomatic links with Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, to support the Taliban.
And then you have Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor for Carter. Can you talk about their role? Well, they're described as elder statesmen. In fact, they were paid lobbyists for the oil consortium that was quite interested in Afghanistan. Can you talk about their role?
Well, Unocol hired some of the top names in the United States to lobby Congress, lobby the U.S. Administration. The U.S. administration was also on board, but Congress was very divided about this issue, you know, whether this should be whether this was a feasible route for a pipeline, building a pipeline in the middle of a civil war and backing a very extremist fundamentalist group to secure it and act as guards for it. So, you know, Unocol hired several former ambassadors to Pakistan and you know, other luminaries to lobby for them, not only inside the United States, but they used these figures to also lobby with Pakistan, with Saudi Arabia. And in fact, some leading figures were sent off to Moscow to in fact tell the Russians that this pipeline wouldn't be a threat to their interests and that they should drop their opposition to this pipeline.
Kissinger in particular?
Kissinger in particular. I mean, you know, both of them, Brzezinski and Kissinger, I think traveled to Moscow at least twice to try and get Russian acquiescence to this pipeline.
There's been some very interesting reiteration of an interview that actually was done a while ago with a French newspaper, French journalist, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, where he talked about the U.S. not supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviet takeover, meaning after the Soviets moved into Afghanistan, but the U.S. supporting the Mujahideen before the Soviets took over to actually provoke them into getting mired in their own Vietnam, which was Afghanistan. And the quote of Brzezinski in this interview is, he answered, "What's more important in world history, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire, some agitated Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?" What's your response to this? Some agitated Muslims?
Brzezinski made this comment, actually, after the Soviet withdrawal in 1989, when somebody asked him, what about all these thousands of Arabs who are left there and these other militants from all over the Islamic world that the U.S. had encouraged to come to Afghanistan to fight the jihad against the Soviet Union? And Brzezinski's comment to this, I think, you know, was very telling and negatively speaking, very prophetic about the future. I mean, what he was essentially was saying that these Arabs and these foreigners really didn't matter because the U.S. mission had been achieved, which was, of course, the defeat of the Soviet Union and the withdrawal of Soviet troops in 1989, not realizing, of course, that, you know, the presence of these militants and these Arabs would eventually lead to Osama bin Laden and the bombings of September the 11th.
What role do you think this kind of oil politics that we're talking about plays today? We didn't even talk about your investigating Bridas, the Argentine oil company. And by the way, for listeners, the Bush family is quite involved with Argentine oil politics. And that's just a separate issue, certainly before the September 11th attacks.
Well, clearly, you know, I mean, Afghanistan is still the shortest route to the Gulf from Central Asia. Central Asia is landlocked. There's the U.S. at the moment is backing a hugely expensive pipeline from Central Asia to Turkey, the Mediterranean coast of Turkey, which is now being costed at over $3 billion, and it passes through half a dozen countries. And the oil industry, in fact, is very much against it because it would be very insecure, very long, and very expensive to ship oil down that pipeline, about 2,500 miles. So again, you know, I mean, once this war is over, once there is a transitional government in Afghanistan, there's almost certain to be renewed interest by the oil companies. And I think, you know, the other factor is that if the Americans are going to maintain a military presence in Uzbekistan after this war is over, that is, these bases that it has now signed a treaty with Uzbekistan to maintain bases in southern Uzbekistan in order to attack Afghanistan. If the U.S. is going to maintain a military presence there, I think there will be immediate suspicions that this military presence is going to facilitate, American oil companies coming in to build these pipelines. But, you know, the point to make, I think, here is that Afghanistan would benefit hugely from these pipelines, but they have to be done, or they have to be built or proposed, as part of the attempt to reconstruct Afghan economy and Afghan society. If these oil companies are going to come in and continue their kind of cutthroat competition between each other, then you are going to have another great game, and Afghanistan is going to suffer hugely.
We haven't even talked about Chevron, which dwarfs Unocal, and it's the largest corporation headquartered in California and a much more major player when it comes to world oil politics, even in this region. Can you talk about Chevron in Central Asia?
Well, Chevron has huge resources in Kazakhstan. It's bought up some of the most lucrative oil fields in Kazakhstan and is developing them. And it is very heavily involved in constructing pipelines. It's just completed a pipeline to the Black Sea, which goes through Russian territory. It's not something that the Americans have particularly liked because it does mean that the pipeline is held hostage to Russia. But essentially, Chevron would like to see, and the Americans would like to see, a new pipeline which would avoid Russia and skirt southern Central Asia and through the Caucasus and go into Turkey, which is a hugely costly venture. But again, you know, Chevron's role in Kazakhstan is very questionable because in Kazakhstan you have a dictatorship. You have massive repression. There's huge amount of corruption. A lot of this corruption has been fueled by the oil companies because they give these bonuses, these junkets, you know, in order to get the contracts. And then you have a government and a state which is basically in a very weak, enfeebled position.
Finally, Ahmed Rashid, the issue of oil is not getting very much play right now. You're one of the few people who's written extensively about it. You write in your book that when you were doing the investigations, the companies like Brightus and Unocal thought you were a spy secretly working for the other company. Why isn't this major player? Often corporations have more money than the whole, you know, gross domestic product of a country. Why aren't the corporations getting the kind of attention that would explain how Afghanistan has developed?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, that is the, you know, the fault of the media. The fact is that these oil companies provide enormous advertising revenue for the big networks and for the print media in America and in Europe. And there's a reluctance to explore, you know, the role of these oil companies. Very simple things. I mean, the fact is that these oil companies are probably the least transparent companies in the world today. You cannot get any information about them from them. It took me 2 years of constant badgering to meet the head of Unocal, who I finally interviewed, only because I cornered him at Davos, in fact, in Switzerland, and he had no choice. And I mean, you know, Unocal, did their best to avoid any kind of answers to, you know, very basic questions that I wanted answered, and I'm sure a lot of other people wanted answered. So, you know, I think this is the same for, you know, they have huge PR departments, public relations departments, which are basically involved in not providing information, but preventing anyone from coming too close to their companies.
Ahmed Rashid, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, I want to move from oil politics to the man who was one of the leading anti-Taliban leaders killed in Afghanistan, since you knew him for more than 20 years. You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile. Our guest, Ahmed Rashid, author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, as we talk about the oily road to war in Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Deep in your deep soul is over.
Deep as a river.
Wait on deep in your deep, deep soul. River is a winning goal to make you move. Wait on deep in your deep, deep soul is over.
Deep as a river. Deep as a river.
Way down deep in your deep, deep heart is a fire.
Deep is a fire.
Way down deep in your deep, deep heart is a fire.
Deep is a fire.
Way down deep in your deep, deep heart. Fire is a blaze and love is a spark. Way down deep in your deep, deep heart is a fire.
Deep is a fire.
Way down deep in your deep, deep mind is a garden. Way down deep in your deep, deep mind is a garden.
This is the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, continuing our conversation with Ahmed Rashid in Islamabad, author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. You recently wrote a piece about Abdul Haq, who is the anti-Taliban leader, Northern Alliance leader, who was assassinated by the Taliban last Friday deep in Afghanistan. Can you talk about the significance of this killing?
Well, Abdul Haq was a Pashtun tribesman. He had gone in to try and raise a rebellion in the south of the country against the Taliban. But he was also a national figure. He became a national figure in the 1980s during the Afghan war against the Soviet Union. He had carried out spectacular attacks against Soviet forces inside Kabul city, blowing up ammunition dumps and launching ambushes against them. And it was the first attempt by a Pashtun tribesman who are anti-Taliban and also loyal to the former king, Zahir Shah, to have gone into the country and to see if they could have got Taliban defectors and if they could have mobilized some of the tribes to launch an attack on the Taliban in the south. That is where the biggest weakness is at the moment of the U.S. campaign, because there's no anti-Taliban resistance in the south.
He knew that, didn't he?
Well, certainly. I mean, he knew it was a very tough job. He'd been living several years in exile in Dubai. He came back. I was in Peshawar to condole with his family. I knew him extremely well for more than 20 years. He was a very good friend, and many of his family members said that he was too hasty. He went in before proper preparations had been made. But I think, you know, the other factor was that they were all extremely critical of the United States because they said the U.S. Did not back this effort. He needed help in logistics and in other issues. But there wasn't much encouragement from the United States, and there certainly wasn't any kind of material help.
Now, why was this? I mean, presumably he was going in to try to get Taliban defectors. The U.S. has since hailed him as a great leader and has seen this as has expressed that it is a serious defeat for them because he would have been a key player in a post-Taliban government.
Well, I think partly, I mean, some officials were prejudiced against him in the U.S. administration in the sense that, you know, they thought he was a media hound and that he was doing this for kind of instant popularity rather than a long-term program. But I think, you know, the key is that, you know, U.S. strategy in the South, how exactly the U.S. wants to try and create a anti-Taliban resistance amongst the Pashtuns, that strategy is not clear at all. I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion in Washington about many things. I mean, the air campaign, the ground campaign, but also to what extent should the U.S. be backing the former king? Should they be backing his commanders who want to go inside Afghanistan? It's not clear at all, and there are different lobbies between the State Department, the Pentagon, and the Central Intelligence Agency. But, you know, there's no clear strategy yet that seems to have emerged.
Abdul-Haq was quite critical of the United States, is that right? Would that be why they didn't support him? And did they offer to give him, for example, a satellite phone, which he didn't want to use because he was concerned that they would be tracking everything he was saying?
That, you know, is partly true. He had become very critical of the bombing. He was saying in the last few days he was in Peshawar before he left that the bombing, in fact, was preventing Taliban from defecting. It was preventing Pashtuns from joining an anti-Taliban resistance. And the U.S. did belatedly, I mean, his family members told me that the U.S. did offer a satellite phone, which he refused.
Ahmed Rashid, are we seeing a kind of replay of the Kurdish, the U.S. Approach to the Kurds? On the one hand, the U.S. under Bush the First was saying they wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And at the point where the Kurds were going to attack, even though the U.S. government had worked with them, had financed them, they pulled back, leading to the massacre of many Kurds by the Iraqi forces. Are we seeing a similar situation play out here?
Well, here, actually, we haven't even seen a decision by the U.S., you know, to back these commanders. That's the problem. I mean, the Kurdish situation evolved after U.S. gave backing and then backed out. Here you have a situation where the U.S. yet has to decide whether to give backing or not. So, you know, it's a much more fundamental problem. And I think, you know, it's linked to the overall sense of a very directionless strategy at the moment. We've had 4 weeks of bombing. You've not seen any major cities fall. You've not seen Taliban defections, as they said. You haven't seen any retreat of the Taliban troops on the front line. In fact, you've seen a very aggressive counterattack, especially in northern Afghanistan. And I think, you know, U.S. strategy has not been well defined. I think there was a serious miscalculation in the beginning. They thought that a week or two of bombing and the Taliban would crumble. Well, you know, they should have, you know, taken into notice simply that this was the nation that defeated the Soviet Union after 10 years of war. And this, you know, these Afghans were not Iraqis, they were not Kosovos, they were not anyone else, but they were Afghans. And there was a whole different dynamic at work here. Now, once that kind of miscalculation was made and the Taliban did not crumble, the U.S. has kind of, you know, got bogged down in the strategy of having to continue the bombing because it would be a loss of face if they suspended the bombing or tried to change their tactics. But I think, you know, the situation does demand a very serious strategic review.
We're talking to Ahmed Rashid. His book is called Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. He's speaking to us from Islamabad. What about the threat to the stability of Pakistan of the U.S. support for the Northern Alliance?
Well, certainly this stalemate in the bombing campaign has created a revival of protest here and perhaps greater instability. We've seen, after October 7th, when the bombing started, there was a whole round of very heavy demonstrations against the government for siding with the Americans. And then there was a lull. And for about 10 days, people thought, well, Musharraf has weathered the worst storm, and now it's kind of cooling down, and people have got resigned to what is going on, and they'll accept it. But in the last 4 or 5 days, we've seen an escalation in the violence here. There have been large demonstrations for the first time in Punjab province, which has been totally unaffected so far by any large demonstrations against the bombing and against Musharraf. The fundamentalist parties are now threatening to march on Islamabad and lay siege to Islamabad and stage a sit-in until Musharraf resigns or is toppled. You have some fundamentalist leaders even asking the army to launch a coup against him, which is, according to Pakistani law, both treasonable and highly provocative, but they haven't been arrested or anything. And then in the north of the country, there's even greater trouble. The strategic road between Pakistan and China has been blocked at 7 or 8 points by Islamic militants, tribesmen, who are protesting the American presence and fear that there may be American bases set up in the north of the country. So the situation has become more fragile in the last few days.
Why is this ancient Silk Route, the roads between Pakistan and China, so strategic?
Well, it is the land route for trade, but more importantly, it's also the major route for Chinese military supplies to Pakistan. China is the largest provider of military equipment to Pakistan, and this road, is very important for that reason. And of course, it also demonstrates that, the government has lost control in a vast chunk of territory up in the north of the country. They have not yet decided to send the army in to clear the road and to clear these tribals off the road. But this doesn't bode well. And this kind of action could be copied by other tribal groups in other provinces, virtually creating no-go areas for the government and undermining state authority.
Ahmed Rashid is author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. We're going to turn now to the status of the health of women, a survey that was done before the bombing, the first one inside of the country. But first, a little music from Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Women should be a priority, respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority figures, like the media that trashes us, play down the hype that constantly bashes our image. TV movies and the videos use women's bodies to create a sick sideshow, too many times seen as a sex symbol, no real intelligence, just a brainless bimbo.
Exile, the War and Peace Report. We're joined by Susanna Serkin, who is with Physicians for Human Rights, and they've just come out with a new report, their second, called Women's Health and Human Rights in Afghanistan, a population-based assessment. And it's the first report that is based on a population-wide survey within Afghanistan. This is before September 11th, obviously. Of the women's health and human rights situation inside the country. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, tell us what you found.
Well, we conducted a survey in both Taliban and non-Taliban controlled areas of over 700 Afghan women and about 500 men to inquire about their health and their access to health care and their human rights under the Taliban regime or in the aftermath of the 96 takeover of the whole, most of the country by the Taliban. We found that for women, their health, their mental health, their access to jobs, et cetera, had declined fairly precipitously in the past 4 years. Now, that cannot alone be attributed to the Taliban's rule. That's probably one factor of which they attribute some blame, but also the severe drought of the last 3 years. What was really interesting that we found from the survey was that a very large number, about 90% of the people we surveyed, believed very strongly that women should be allowed to be educated in Afghanistan, that Afghan women should work, be allowed to work if they so choose, that they should participate in society, perhaps even in government, and quite a large number also felt that they shouldn't be forced to wear the chaudhuri, the full head covering down to the ankles that the Taliban require.
How did you get, how did you have the survey done inside Afghanistan under the Taliban regime?
That's difficult to tell you in detail, but we had access to several populations. We were able to conduct a random survey in people's homes, and we worked very closely with various colleagues. We also surveyed and have surveyed previously women in refugee camps in Pakistan who had left some years ago, and also we sampled a set of people who were preparing to go back to Afghanistan. This was in the year 2000, people who had been refugees and who were going back.
Mm-hmm. We recently had on a member of the RAWA, Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, and they said that they felt that the human rights abuses under the Mujahideen before the Taliban were as bad under the Northern Alliance. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it depends what human rights abuses you're talking about. I mean, certainly under those regimes there have been torture, imprisonment, executions, severe human rights violations, rape probably, although I'm not sure of what documentation there is on that as well, as have also been attributed to the Northern Alliance forces now working presumably with the British and American forces. But I think in terms of restrictions on the rights of women, the Taliban edicts issued in 1996 after the Taliban took over the capital of Kabul have been more severe explicitly in terms of women's rights than any previous regime.
Susanna Serkin, who is with Physicians for Human Rights based in Boston. And that does it for the program. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music meister and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerlow at KPFA and Aaron Glantz. Thanks to KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, all of our Pacific affiliates. We are Pacifica. Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno are our hosts. We're broadcasting on WFMU 91.1 FM in Manhattan, as well as community radio stations around the country and Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 34 on Dish Network, Free Speech TV Channel 9415. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Bend and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman.